morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can also find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'd like now to welcome John Wasik. He's the author of the book Cul-de-sac Syndrome, Turning Around the Unsustainable American Dream, published by Bloomberg Press. He's a personal finance columnist for Bloomberg Press and the author of several other books as well. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me, Mary Charlotte.
So you look at the current economic crisis and the entire issue of housing in the United States from multiple perspectives. There is, of course, the issue of people taking out mortgages they couldn't afford, and then Wall Street bundling and continually reselling bad debts as if they were good. But you go back to Thomas Jefferson and his ideas of home ownership and community. What was Jefferson's thinking that's still with us today?
Well, I actually went back to his little mountain, Monticello, and tried to get into his head a little bit, and came up with the conclusion that, you know, he foresaw a country that was going to be decentralized. He wanted a grid system laid out. He wanted to see a whole system of self-sufficient landowners working farms, making their own living. And by and large, that was kind of the model for the 19th century. And then the whole grid idea took hold, that you could organize all this land in the communities, townships, various communities that were centered on an idea that the land was very important. It was the center of our society. It was part of our cultural DNA. So this really came actually earlier than Jefferson. The whole idea of people coming over here to grab a piece of land and doing something with it has been with us for more than 400 years.
The idea of the grid and the checkerboard pattern that includes houses and nature, farms and people, it's really a Cartesian sort of enlightenment way of thinking. And one of the things that's striking about it is that it doesn't take into account the actual facts of the land, which are inherently nonlinear. Rivers and hills and watersheds and so on don't conform to grids. What are some of the advantages and disadvantages that have come about as a result of grid thinking, so to speak?
Well, that's really lasted a lot longer than I think we needed to bear in terms of sustainability. We really didn't think of land as being part of an overall system. We stopped thinking about watersheds. We stopped thinking about connectivity and how cities relate to suburbs. And as a result, we got a massive sprawl. We had this idea that land got cheaper the further you got out from a city. And then there was building on this land, whether it was decent farmland or sides of mountains or deserts. We built anywhere because the land was cheaper. And we wanted to give people that piece of the Jeffersonian dream, that piece of independence, a lot, a huge house, something more for your money. We kept pushing further and further out. And it was just unsustainable. It was not something that could have been justified in terms of the economics, because the cost always caught up with those outliers, with the people living out in what I call spurbs, the sprawling urban areas. Energy is going to catch up with us again as the prices are rising, and also other costs, economic costs, the cost of infrastructure, everything is really made that cheap land deal obsolete.
The current suburb, the spurb, the urban sprawl, how did that come into being? I mean, you make a distinction between good and not-so-good suburbs.
Well, the whole idea there was that everybody wanted their piece of the pie. Everybody thought they could own a home. When Alan Greenspan lowered interest rates 11 times, cheap money flooded the system. Mortgage brokers, the real estate industry, builders all said, hey, this is our gold rush. This is our time to really prosper, to sell a home to anybody who wants it, and that's exactly what they did. It was what I call the buffet effect, where you provide a cheap commodity, and in this case, money, and then people gorge on it, and they eat as much as they can of it. And as a result, we overbuilt, we overspent, we overleveraged, and now we're kind of paying the price for that.
ground us in time. I mean, the worst of that, is that a 90s thing? Is that a whole, like, 1945 to the present deal?
Well, the whole concept of building everywhere was really a post-World War II phenomenon, and that really began with the whole subsidies that came with GIs returning home. We subsidized mortgages, we subsidized mortgage interest, we subsidized property taxes through the tax code, and we provided numerous benefits to road builders to just keep building roads over other systems, such as public transportation, that would really link cities and suburbs. So we really put our dollars into suburban development and really starved the cities over a long period of time.
What do you mean by cul-de-sac syndrome? That's the title of the book.
This is an idea that we had hit a dead end. We had gone the route, and we're in this place where we needed to back out and start take a look at what we had done and where we're going. The economics of it wasn't sustainable. Culturally, it wasn't sustainable. It's adversely impacted our health, our well-being, our communities, our families. And we just have to kind of back out of this place and say, look, do we really want to be doing this going forward? Are we really doing something that's beneficial for everyone in the 21st century? My overall conclusion was that no, it isn't. And we can do it a lot better.
And we'll get to that in a little while. We have, there's a lot of positive and innovative ideas in your book. But I want to stay for a moment on some of the problems so that we can really look at them clearly. And one of the problems is speculation. You write about people, one family in particular, that basically bought lots of houses, not necessarily to flip them overnight, but as an investment in Florida, didn't work out very well. In fact, a lot of things went wrong. Speculation in housing is a dangerous game, just as all speculation is a dangerous game. But in a way, so what? I mean, when people speculate and they lose their shirts, that's what you get when you speculate half the time. Is it not?
Well, the casino mentality was aided and abetted by this whole system of subsidies. We tell people, look, leverage as much as you can. Buy as much house as you can afford. That's been the mantra since 1946 almost. And we're going to back up your mortgage. We are going to give you a break on your interest on your first and second homes. We are going to give you a break on capital gains if you sell your home beyond 2 years. And we'll give you every break in the world. It's the most subsidized industry practically in the country. So we're saying to people, look, this is what we want you to do, and we're giving you all these rational incentives to do it. And on top of that, we are telling you, well, you can't lose any money. You know, some people would call it speculation, but we're saying it's the sure thing. At least that was the thinking then. Now we realize we exposed people to all these market forces, to derivatives, to the bond market, and it was dangerous. It was worse than speculation because there was a downside that nobody even acknowledged.
Is the system as it stands now able to differentiate between people who bought a house to live in it and those who bought multiple properties to buy and sell them?
Well, the pendulum is really swung in the other direction. With the credit bubble exploding, the credit crunch has really prevented a lot of people with halfway decent credit from buying. So now there are a lot of people who really want to get a home and get a decent mortgage with money down, and a good payment history and all these things, and they're not able to do it. The banks are putting the squeeze on everybody, and as a result, the housing market is going to be even slower to recover.
We're talking to John Wasik. His book is called The Cul-de-Sac Syndrome. It seems to me that, I mean, we've been taught, as you say, to think about housing as an investment as opposed to a place to live, and that seems like a very American thing, and it's not necessarily a good thing. I mean, many Europeans, they buy one house, they never move, they're a lot less mobile, and this can make for more stable communities and stable economics. Is that not true?
It is, and I have nothing against home ownership. I think it's a great thing. However, you should really tell people that the long-term rate of appreciation for a home is somewhat less than the rate of inflation. When you subtract taxes and financing and maintenance and the things you do to a house, you're really not making that much money. And what happened during the last bubble was a mania. People just grabbed on to any property they could get a hold of, thinking that this was the next best thing. And really, they did it out of desperation. Their social safety net, it was frayed to almost nothing. They got nailed during the dot-com bust. 401k balances were horrible. Not enough for people to retire on. The defined benefit pensions were going away for most people. And on top of that, there wasn't anything else to back these things up that used to be that people used to think were solid vehicles. So we were exposed to market risk in our retirement plans, and then it went on to our big nest egg, our home, and people thought they couldn't lose, and they sort of bet the house against that, pun intended, and they lost.
I think that the ways in which the middle class has been put in the position of even taking those risks is well explained in your book. You talk about the shifting of risk on part of corporations from the corporations themselves to their employees in, what, the last 20 years or so?
It's been happening over the last generation, and it's been very subtle. It's like a frog, and you put him in a pot and start boiling, and after a while he realizes that he's boiling, but not at first. Benefits have been eroding over the years. The whole social contract is just almost non-existent. There is no job security, even in government these days. So your corporate employer has been cutting back on health benefits. Meanwhile, health care costs have been going up. Less and less is being covered. And that goes across the board. And people just said to themselves, my God, I'm working more. My wages are not keeping up with all these benefit cuts and inflation itself. What's left? And so they reached the rational conclusion, at least at the time, that home ownership was the only way to get ahead. And so many people dived into it, and it was just an overreaction.
It is funny that that phenomenon happened pretty much simultaneously with the phenomenon of, like, mini mansions with granite countertops and commercial-level stoves and all these sort of crazy luxury housing that you see in this country, when there was actually a lot more risk on the part of the people who were buying these.
You know, they didn't think that they were taking more risk because, of course, all the people in the industry were telling them, look, you'll never pay off this loan. You can sell the house, make a profit, get even more house than you could even dream of, you know, max to the hilt with leverage, and you won't have to worry about it because, you know, this rampant appreciation is just going to take care of you. And on top of that, they tapped all of their equity. They took out more money and got into more debt because they thought that this was a sure thing. And we found out that it really wasn't.
Now, for some people, inflation hasn't been very, very bad, but for others, it's been absolutely terrible. What costs of living have gone up over the last generation or so?
Boy, just about everything. You name it. College tuition inflation has been double-digit for years. Healthcare has been out of control. You look at just about anything. The cost of maintaining a home, the cost of maintaining a car, transportation costs, energy costs, everything has gone up. Food was kind of staying level for a while, and then that shot up last year during the commodity bubble, which also kind of fell back down to earth, and a lot of people didn't realize that. But, you know, wages are not keeping up with inflation. They're just not keeping pace with the cost of living, and people are doing whatever they need to do, and that usually means working more. That usually means, you know, thinking that there's some way to repair this damage.
Another example you give in the book is property tax, and you write about the wisdom of detaching local property taxes from local services like schools and roads and other infrastructure. What would be a better model?
Well, I have to kind of lay out the whole paradigm. First of all, in most places, property taxes fund schools, libraries, fire departments, things like that. And really, their budgets are based on the fact that home valuations are always going up. Well, now we're in a situation where they're going the other direction. What do? They sell fire engines, they close libraries, they cut school programs, things like that. And it's really awful because nobody has really lived through this phase. My idea is to say, look, let's not link all these local services to the value of homes in the area. Let's diversify the tax services and say, look, let's get a little bit of a piece from, say, state income taxes, a little bit from excise taxes, some more from sin taxes. Tax the stuff that's really bad. Carbon taxes don't look like they're going to make it through, but in certain places they make sense. And look at the things that are really harmful to society. You know, certain health, certain foods are not healthy. Certain kinds of cars are clearly gas guzzlers, and we should be taking a look at that.
You also write about how our lifestyle has changed, including increased energy consumption. What are the things that we do and that we use so much more energy than we used to, again, you know, in this, let's say, the 70s?
Well, I looked at two principal things. One, because we are living further out from our jobs, we're spending a lot more time in our cars. That means more pollution. That means more exposure to pollution. That means more obesity because we're not getting out. It means any number of ill health effects, more diabetes, more asthma. The air is actually worse in some places, and you're breathing this stuff all the time while you're on the highway. And as a result, it really takes us away from our families, from our communities. People are less involved in communities. And also, because we are stuck in this mode where we are willing to live further out to get that great castle and that piece of land, it is just really taking away a bit of democracy. We're unable to go to school board meetings. We just don't have the time to attend some civic organizations. If there's money that needs to be raised, we're not around to do it. So I think as a result, it really hurts our ability to be citizens and participate in what needs to be done in the country.
There are also some other things which, I mean, I was actually surprised to see how much energy is used by computers and, for example, plasma TVs.
Well, consider this. I mean, in the last 10 years, think about all the new appliances that have been added to the home. People want computers. They want several computers. They want several flat-screen TVs. The plasma screens take up an enormous amount of power. And all this really means you have to create more power to get these things running and to keep them running. They're all sucking up juice all the time. And we demand this of our modern home. We want to have Internet access. We want to have our cell phones. We want to have our iPods. It means more power. It means, gosh, you know, in most places they have to burn a lot of coal to make that power, unless you have nuclear or hydro, and that's really the minority of power being generated. New Mexico, of course, is blessed with a lot of solar power, but we need some more tax incentives to get solar panels just about everywhere we can put them. That just hasn't happened yet.
You spend a lot of the book talking about, writing about better ideas for doing development and building housing. What are some of the more important and promising innovations that you've seen for doing things differently than we do them now?
Well, there's a whole movement called New Urbanism, and that's really kind of taking Americans back to the idea that at one time we had towns with actual centers in them where you could walk to the post office and the library and the all kinds of shopping and the bakery, and all these things were kind of within walking distance. Most old cities have neighborhoods like this, and I know Albuquerque and Santa Fe do too. But in most places, you know, you have sprawl, you have suburbs, you got to drive everywhere. I'm really calling for a look at more walkable, more bike-friendly places, more public transportation. Get people out of cars, get them talking to their neighbors, get them, you know, stopping on their porches for a cup of coffee. That's going to bring back community, I think, and it's also going to make us healthier.
It's tricky business because even in Santa Fe, I mean, there's a downtown, but nobody lives there because it's not residential and it's too expensive for most people to live there anyway. And a lot of development is done in such a way that there is no porch. And in other words, if you go out in front of your house, all there is a garage. I mean, a lot of it is not something that human beings can do by just changing their lifestyles. The design is built up all around us and really controls our behavior.
Well, design is intention, as William McDonough, the architect, says. And that just means, look, we can design human-scale communities. I live in a community where just about every house has a porch, and you can walk to one end to the other through trails, through sidewalks, through any number of ways, and you don't have to get in a car to do it. So we have to start designing places for people again. Can you walk to your grocery store? Can you walk to the dry cleaner? You know, can you walk to a movie? And they have to be affordable as well. Half of my book really deals with green buildings, saying, look, homes don't have to be this expensive. If you design green homes, you design them in scale, you do modular kind of construction, they can be a lot less expensive. You can put up a lot more units. You can have higher density. You can have things closer together, and you don't have to drive to get there.
Talk about the modular idea. I mean, there's a lot of so-called green housing that you describe in the book that people are wary of because some of it is prefabricated, and that opens up the idea of trailers or mobile homes.
Well, here again, we have to assault the perception that modular housing is like a trailer that's going to blow away or something. Modular housing is very well constructed, tight, green housing that's built in factories and is built to be assembled on a site rather than be constructed. Keep in mind that most building technology is a 19th century technology. We wouldn't tolerate that in a cell phone. We wouldn't tolerate that in a flat screen TV. Why do we tolerate it in terms of building our homes? We're still putting up 2x4s and throwing out 3 dumpsters worth per house. It's crazy. It's wasteful. We're wasting a lot of energy just in the design. This modular technology that I'm talking about exists. It's been around for a long time. It's getting better and should progress at the rate of, you know, improvements in a cell phone. Think of all the things you can do with a cell phone. It's a GPS unit. It's a camera. It's a phone. It's an internet access device. We can do these things with homes, and we have the technology now.
Describe that technology a little more. What do we have that's so different from the 2x4 construction that basically everybody's still doing, at least around here?
Well, let's start with a module. This is essentially a unit where all the homes are really super insulated. They are tight. They have all the heating electrical hardwired into them. And then you load it up to a flatbed truck and you assemble it on site. You save a tremendous amount of labor, a tremendous amount of cost, and it's a tighter, greener home. You can put more insulated materials in these panels that make up the walls. You can build better electrical systems. You can hardwire solar panels into a pre-assembled roof. You don't even have to deal with brackets and having somebody, you know, jerry-rig your home for this stuff. You can build it in the walls and windows if you like. The technology is coming along where you can have every south-facing surface producing electricity. And this should be done in a factory. It shouldn't be done on site. It shouldn't be haphazard. And all it takes is to really create some incentives, and I'm seeing some more coming through the climate change legislation, to do this in every home. It should be second nature.
Most people live in houses that already exist. I mean, my mother just moved here from a house that was built in the 1880s or something like that. And, of course, it uses up huge amounts of energy. For existing homes, I mean, I know there are programs to put in weather stripping and to insulate the homes a little bit better and so on, and to really do some of the most obvious things about keeping cold air out. But can existing big old or just drafty houses be changed and modified to make enough of a difference as a new house along the lines you're saying would make?
Well, it's never going to be as good as a new modular design, but there's a lot that can be done. One of my fail-safe predictions is that one of the big jobs in the future is going to be an energy auditor. And this is somebody who goes into a structure and says, yeah, we can button this up and patch this up, and you're going to improve your overall performance of the home by 30, 40, 50%. This can be done in so many different levels. We're already offering tax subsidies for energy-efficient windows, doors, fans, solar panels, geothermal units. I mean, there's a whole raft. Just go to the IRS website and punch in, like, energy efficiency and tax credits. and it's all part of the stimulus plan, and I hope we keep them on the books for a long time, and get even more aggressive and offer even more incentives to do this. And another thing that's happening is the national labs, the national DOE labs, which originally set up to do nuclear energy and build bombs, are really much more into energy production and also energy efficiency. Oak Ridge, which is one of the first in the Manhattan projects, is oriented towards green building technology. And I know they're doing a lot in New Mexico on this front, too. And I say, let's keep it going. Let's put more money into it and commercialize it.
We're talking to John Wasik, author of The Cul-de-Sac Syndrome, Turning Around the Unsustainable American Dream. There's this really weird, interesting, and sort of surrealistic part of the book where you describe being in Florida and going to some kind of multi-million-dollar supposed green house that people, you know, the people, if they've got lots of money, can buy and live in a supposedly ecological manner, and yet it's kind of a joke, and there is a kind of what you call faux green, or you know, maybe green chic that's coming up that needs to be recognized for what it is.
Well, very simply, I think that every structure should be green in some way, and we need to mass produce green homes that produce energy the way Henry Ford started to mass produce cars. Let's put them on assembly lines. Let's rebuild cities. If we're going to create a suburb, let's mandate that everybody does something that's energy efficient. And over time, when the technology improves, we can retrofit these homes to put in even more efficient solar collectors, put in even more efficient heating and cooling units. Technology changes, and most homes have units in them that are 20, 30 years old. Why not let people update these things and give them incentives to do so? So when I was in Florida, I drove from one end to the other, and it's Florida is the ultimate experience in terms of what is happening and what could happen. They're doing some solar, but certainly not enough. And you can see from Disneyland down to the tip of Key West, I mean, there's solar panels popping up here and there. But you know that if the incentives were right, they would be ubiquitous. There would be more solar panels and billboards everywhere. And I'm not just talking about Florida. New Mexico is a ripe location to do solar in every single unit. But we have to provide the political will to tell our leaders, say, look, this is what we should be doing. I mean, if you have a building, a facility that is energy self-sufficient, guess what? You're lowering operating costs. You can pay people more money. You can offer them more benefits. It's a win-win situation.
You must have been writing this book before the crash last year. What was your original idea?
Well, Mary Charlotte, I wrote a whole book, and then I threw out half of it because the housing market absolutely melted down. And I said to myself, well, you know, I have another story to tell here. I really have to explain what was going on with this whole mess economically. And then I originally wanted to do a book on green building. I thought, you know, I want to make an argument for green building, an economic argument, which wasn't hard to do. But after the housing meltdown, I really had to go back and completely revisit the idea. And I came to the same conclusion that, you know, look, all of this was unsustainable, and it still is, and we can't go back to the way we were doing things. It just is going to throw people out of work again. We're going to see the same mess again. We're going to create the same old suburbs with the same old driving patterns, the same old traffic jams. You know, there's so many better ways of doing this, and they already are with us. All we have to do is acknowledge them and tell our leaders, look, here's a new path, but it's really the old path, and let's take another look at reimagining the American dream.
When you say it's the old path, what do you mean?
Well, in terms of, you know, take any small town that you can think of. How is it laid out? And I really started out with Williamsburg, which inspired Jefferson. But you take any, like, old 19th or even 18th century town, it was intelligently laid out. Here's the government office at one end. At the other end were, you know, private facilities and different shops and stores. But it was all within, like, a mile radius. And you didn't have to, you know, of course, there were no cars back then, but it was all sensibly laid out, very human scale. You know, we can go back to that. Only building energy efficient buildings in terms of these old kind of grids and layouts. There are really old ideas that still work.
One of the points you make in your book is about the importance of re-enlivening downtown areas and inner cities as opposed to doing this, as you say, continued suburban sprawl. How should that best be done, and who has done it well?
Well, there's a number of cities that are really tackling this big time. Portland, Oregon is a good example. You look at Seattle, that's a good place to go. And throughout the West, there are cities who are really taking another look at how to get people downtown. And why should we be doing this? Well, there's already infrastructure there. We already have water mains and libraries and shops and theaters and operas and places where people want to go, and they just need the places to live in and the affordable units to live in, and we have to create some incentives, and we have to redirect our whole idea of how do we best house people as they're getting older. And they won't want to walk that much more. They won't want to be in cars that much more, but they will want to walk more. And you look at some of the older cities, Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York, Chicago, they all have great neighborhoods. Why don't we think about neighborhoods instead of developments? A development is something where somebody wipes out a piece of land and starts over and doesn't even think about a center, doesn't even think about where things should be and how people can get there.
And often those developments are done on land that could be used to produce food, and food shortage is not a, it's an important problem that we could easily face.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, the population direction of this planet is heading towards 7-8 billion people. And if we're wiping out, you know, great farmland, how are we going to feed all these folks? There's only so much land in China. They're going to need land. There's so much arable land in India, which is not known for agriculture. We're wiping out some beautiful Midwestern farm fields for subdivisions that people can't afford.
So you, again, getting back to this question of re-enlivening the city, you write that current zoning codes are basically dead set against this. What is in the current zoning laws that make it more difficult to do residential development within existing cities?
Well, here's one of the greatest ideas that you found in a lot of the old neighborhoods, and it's called mixed-use zoning. That is, you can have an apartment building next to a few commercial buildings. You know, you have your baker, your tailor, your little bodega, and I'm thinking of, you know, some of the older cities. But in most places, in most suburbs, inner suburbs, and even some cities, they've effectively outlawed that. They said, okay, you're going to have a strip mall over here, and you're going to have residential all over here. And the only way you get from point A to point B is through this busy highway, a million intersections, lots of street lights, and it's just, it doesn't make sense anymore. I mean, in the age of, like, land being cheap and highways being built everywhere, that made sense. But energy is still going up in price. Land is not really a commodity anymore. It's becoming even more precious, and we have to rethink that whole way of seeing land.
Some places have actually torn down highways. Tell us about some of these.
Well, there's a great example of San Francisco along the Embarcadero, the expressway going along that part of the peninsula was damaged during the earthquake, I think in '89, and they just tore it down. And as a result, it opened up that whole waterfront. The land values rose dramatically, and people could use that whole area rather than being shadowed by this, you know, big highway ramp and overhang. It became land that people actually valued and wanted to live on, and their shops opening up, and it's been quite a renaissance. But they can do that in a lot of cities. They've been completely crisscrossed and bisected by expressways. And that kills neighborhoods. And let's say to ourselves, look, what's more important to us, a city that's ruled by cars and concrete and asphalt, or a city that's really a city of communities and neighborhoods? And this applies to suburbs as well.
I used to live in Boston, and I found it sort of horrifying that both banks of the Charles River were covered with very highly trafficked roads instead of basically grass and access to the river.
Well, this is an important element in every urban setting. You go to Toronto in Canada, and a lot of the waterfront's taken up by, you know, commercial property. Boston's a good example. New York's a good example. And this whole movement to reclaim the land for people has been going on since Frederick Law Olmsted's, who I profiled in the book. And really, it's an understanding that the land is a commons. It belongs to people. It should be cherished by people. It should be parkland. Here in Chicago, we're celebrating the 100th anniversary of the 1909 plan of Daniel Burnham. And in the most profound part of the plan was to create a people space, lakefront park space for a good, you know, 25, 30-mile stretch that's still here today, and people want to expand upon it. They say, look, let's take the rest of this plan and finish it. It's 100 years old, and it's remarkable that people revere that kind of planning, that sort of forward-thinking that puts people first.
Tell us more about the work of Frederick Law Olmsted.
Well, Olmsted was more than a parks designer. He was, of course, the principal designer of Central Park in New York, but he designed parks all over the country. And he designed a community called Riverside in, just south of Chicago. And the whole idea there was that, you know, he got away from the grid. He got away from these straight intersections and blocks and everything. And everything was curvilinear. And everybody had a way of seeing the land differently in different vistas. And it was all built along a riverfront. And it was just beautiful. And it's still a beautiful community. Very livable. And on top of that, way ahead of his time. It was one of the first transit-oriented developments. There was a train stop there that took people right into Chicago. So keep in mind this was 1868 that he designed this, so people could commute to Chicago from Riverside. It wasn't that far, but the whole idea that you were not cut off, you were not a suburb, you had some connection to the central city, and you lived in this wonderful park-like setting. We need to get back to that. We need more green space everywhere.
We're talking to John Wasik, author of the book, The Cul-de-Sac Syndrome. You know, you work for Bloomberg. You're a personal finance columnist, and you understand the whole financial and economic picture probably better than most of us. And it seems to me that there's several things going on at once that are contradictory that we don't usually talk about together. One of them is that we want to have our arable land, we want to have peace and beauty, we want to have public transportation and green building and neighborhoods and open space and so on. And on the other hand, we want to have our investments pan out. People who are doing land development want to make profit, and those things, really making a profit and having your investments turn well, is that antithetical to or in conflict with some of these other goals?
No, not at all. In fact, and I got to detail this a little bit in the book, but, you know, if you offer people green space, if you offer them parks in the middle of a city, if you give them open space, the land surrounding it will be more valuable. You can charge higher rents. You can charge higher per square foot cost for whatever you build there. People always want to view. We're biophilic creatures. We need to see open space because that's part of our DNA. So wherever you do it, whether it's in the middle of Manhattan or the middle of Santa Fe or the middle of Chicago, it increases the value and the real psychic pleasure of living next to green and open space. And this has been proven in studies where they look at different ways of landscaping. If it's just, you know, like house, street, you know, it has a limited value. You're treating land as a commodity. You're not bringing into any sort of land ethic, which Aldo Leopold really favored. But you have to see it differently. You have to say, look, let's start with the park and then design the homes the way Olmsted did. And it's not really a new idea, but it's something we need to revisit.
Then you get maybe into the opposite problem, which is the problem of affordability for ordinary people.
Well, that's key to this. I think that if we are going to move forward in reimagining the American dream, and we want home ownership extended to as many people as possible, which has always been the goal since the end of World War II. We're going to have to provide more rental properties. We're going to have to provide more affordable housing. And how do we do that? Well, you can only do so much with the cost of the land. That's always going to rise. But you can reduce the cost of building by doing green modular building. You can make homes that are creating energy, so you're lowering your ownership costs over time. You can use land more efficiently. You can do denser housing. You can do more with a little space if you do it intelligently. And all this is design, and it's not difficult to do. There's a lot of architects that I mentioned in my book who have already done this and already know how to do it. We just have to provide more incentives to builders and to educate them and to educate policymakers that, look, this is going to benefit more people. You're going to get more people paying more taxes if you can put more of them in the city and make it affordable.
Okay, so let's say people are listening and they say, yeah, we want to do this. What's the most fruitful kind of activism on these issues? Is it your city council? Is it national level? Is it state? I mean, where should people be putting their energy?
Well, I have a couple of suggestions. One, the transportation bill is coming up. And typically, this has been a boatload of subsidies to the highway building industry. If you want to lobby your congressperson, say, look, let's create more incentives for smart growth, for creating walkable communities, for creating more public transportation, more pedestrian and bike trails in cities, suburbs, everywhere. Let's promote connectivity to urban areas rather than just building highways willy-nilly. Let's fix the roads we have. Let's fix the infrastructure we have in the inner suburbs and cities. And let's shift our priorities from just building roads everywhere to build roads to where they're needed and where they can be fixed. Also, we need to reform building codes so that we can do more building in a green mode and sustainability and preserving water on the local level and on the regional level as well. We need to revise zoning codes. That's a local matter. Say we want more mixed-use housing. We want more affordable housing. To do that, you need to change zoning codes. And it takes people to make the time to show up at some of these meetings, to show up at town councils. If there's a mega development going in that's going to cause more sprawl, people need to get out and oppose these things. And believe me, there's so few people attending these meetings that a handful of people can do a lot of good.
Tell us about the designer and architect William McDonough. I mean, in your book, you talk about Frederick Law Olmsted and Buckminster Fuller and Frank Lloyd Wright. McDonough is somebody who's working today and doing a lot of amazing things.
Well, William McDonough is a guy who's kind of extends his legacy from Jefferson to the present and into the future. He lives in a home designed by Jefferson. He has this Jeffersonian vision of the world, and yet he's willing to say, look, we should be designing places so that we respect the land. He's designed several green buildings that are producing energy, saving water, treating wastewater as something that can be recycled. So these are all principles that come into a holistic vision that we need to adopt, and he's one of the best proponents of it.
I found it fascinating that he went to Jordan and became, as you put it, fascinated with the airflow through Bedouin tents. I mean, it's things that, you know, if I were visiting Bedouin tents, airflow is probably the last thing that I'd think about. But just things like airflow make a huge difference in how we live.
Well, when you get into the design of a home, a lot of things are counterintuitive. Why did they put chimneys on homes? Well, the first thing was to draft the air to create a venturi effect. Why did they put cupolas on home? Well, it sucked the hot air out in the summer. And you see this all over, and you're thinking, well, that's just decoration. Well, no, it's not. It had a practical use. There was no air conditioning. And you look at the, you know, things as simple as a Bedouin tent. It provides circulation. And you get into thousands of design elements of a home that can be changed and really made more energy efficient, more human scale. And you're thinking, wait a minute, none of this is high technology. This is been known for thousands of years. You know, why do they use adobe in the Southwest for homes still after 1,000 years or so? Because it's a good building material. But we can expand upon that knowledge. We have better technologies, better materials, better designs. And we don't have to do dumb buildings anymore. We can have homes that respond to the environment in the moment, saying redirecting air from one room to the other, or turning on air conditioning or turning it off. All this technology is here with us. We just have to employ it.
At the end of the book, you write about the cities that have been most and least troubled by the economic and housing crises. Why? Why are some cities in horrible shape and some of them doing okay?
Well, in the case of the worst hit places, say the Central Valley, California, Las Vegas, Phoenix area, Southwest Florida, places like that, there was a lot of overbuilding. And really, people went out there because the land was cheap, the homes were cheap. They gorged on the cheap money when it was available, got into subprime loans, got into piggyback loans where they got two loans, bought investment properties. I mean, they just went crazy. In a lot of cases, like California, homes were expensive to begin with. So they kept building further and further out, and people kept saying, oh, I'm going to get a better value if I get 60, 90 miles away from Los Angeles or San Francisco, and then they got the home they wanted, but then they couldn't afford it. So those places are still going to be in trouble for a long time because there's a lot of properties sitting on the market that will have to be even more discounted. I mean, they're down 40, 50%. They'll have to go down even more before things turn around and the credit crunch will have to end. But there's other places that are going to be in much better shape. Most college towns are okay. Most places in the middle south are all right. Some of the older cities are going to hold up okay. And it's just the case where you have to look where there was extreme speculation. Say in Southwest Florida, they just went absolutely nuts. Everybody and their brother wanted to buy a house to flip it. Same deal in Phoenix. So once all that inventory is washed through the system, then we can get back to saying, okay, how do we rebuild this and not do this again?
It does seem that prices were so high that a lot of ordinary people couldn't afford houses. I mean, is there an advantage for middle-class people in this crash?
Well, the stunning reality is that you really should have a down payment. You really should have some equity in your home. A lot of the people who are walking away, who are getting stuck in foreclosure, have no stake. Their homes are upside down. The mortgage is worth more than what the home is. And they have absolutely no economic stake in that place anymore. So they do a little jingle mail. They mail the keys back to the lender, and they are gone. So that's devastating to a community, and that's why the foreclosure crisis will continue.
Not people who have been, I mean, that's one side of it, but I mean people who are in position whose salary didn't get cut, but the price of housing went down. Are they better placed to actually buy a house?
Well, prices have come down in some areas, but you're still going to need a higher down payment. The credit standards are a lot higher. So those people should be buying houses, and they should be getting a better price, but the system has not quite come around to say, look, it's safe to come out of the woods. There's still a lot of problems in people getting loans right now.
When you look at the whole big picture and what it's going to take to come out of it on two levels, one economically and the other ecologically, what are the most important policies that have been implemented that are good, and what do we need to really push for as citizens?
Well, on the ecological side, I suggest that everybody keep a close eye on the climate change legislation. A huge 1,000-page bill is passed the House. I had a quick read of it and gone through the summary. There is a tremendous amount in there that is going to change everybody's life in some way. And we really have to keep our eye on the whole climate change ball for any number of reasons. We have to reduce our consumption. Energy is only going to get more costly as Asia develops. They're running up the price of commodities. There's only so much oil in the planet left. There's only so much ways of getting at it cheaply. It's going to become more expensive. That's going to affect the cost of nearly everything. So we really have to keep an eye on that. We also have to keep an eye on the fact that You know, homes were too expensive to begin with. Far too many people were pushed into situations where they would do anything to get that mortgage, and they lied, and they got into subprimes, and they got into situations where, you know, they're exposed to market risk, and when it turned the other way, they were completely out of that situation where they could afford the house. So we have to either start guaranteeing mortgages or provide a low source of capital for financing homes and bring down the cost of homes themselves if we're going to maintain this idea of widespread home ownership and the American dream.
John Wasik is a personal finance columnist for Bloomberg News and the author of several books, including The Cul-de-Sac Syndrome, Turning Around the Unsustainable American Dream. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Brian Highhill for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience.